now, Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070.
Good morning. Thanks so much for spending the day with us. And welcome to Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. How are you today?
Enjoying the sunshine. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Well, nice to see you. And I understand you're going to be RVing it in the southern climes.
That's the plan. In a couple of weeks, we're loading the family in a car and heading down to Yellowstone to rent a motorhome.
Yeah. Well, yesterday we were talking about that crash on the Malahat involving a truck and a trailer, and people were calling in like crazy saying, you know, you need to have some sort of training on these things before you get behind the wheel. But you're confident because you've done a big road trip in one before.
We did it about a year and a bit ago in New Zealand. So that was driving on the wrong side of the road and a standard transmission in the motorhome. So you may not need to leave quite as wide a berth around Yellowstone a couple of weeks from now.
That's a few too many variables for me. Okay. Well, this morning we're going to talk about the fact that more than half of the people in Canadian jails have not been proven to have done anything wrong. How can that happen?
Well, those people, and there's a stat that it was something like 55% of the people in provincial jails haven't been convicted of anything. And the reason for that is that those people have been detained, or at least not released, on what's called judicial interim release. The way that works is if somebody's arrested and charged with something, one of the very early decisions to be made as part of the criminal justice process is what's to happen with the person while they await trial. And you have a constitutional right, first of all, to be presumed innocent, which may ring a little bit hollow with the 55% of people or the jail population.
That's astounding.
Yeah, you also have a constitutional right, and it's phrased this way, not to be denied reasonable bail without just cause. So one of the very early things that happens in most criminal cases is what's called a bail hearing. And at a bail hearing, a judge or a justice of the peace needs to decide whether the person who's been accused of committing a crime is going to wait in jail until they have their trial, potentially a number of months down the road, or whether they can be released to be supervised in the community while they await trial. So that's one of the very early things that has to happen, and it can be an extremely important decision. If a person is charged with an offense and they are denied bail, the consequences can be months in jail waiting for their trial, and that can impact on not only their life in an immediate way.
In what circumstances would people be denied bail?
There are, in Canada, three grounds upon which somebody could be held in jail waiting for their trial. The first ground is called the primary ground, and that would be if the Crown could show that a person was not likely to attend court if they were let out.
So flight risk, is that what we call it?
That's right. They would look at things like, does a person have roots in the community? Do they have any previous history of failing to show up when they've been required to show up? Do they have a job and other things which would show that they're unlikely to run away as a result of being charged with an offense? So that's the primary one. The secondary ground is if the detention of the person is necessary, it's phrased as for the protection or safety of the public.
Meaning they might commit a crime again while out on bail.
That's exactly right. So they'd be looking at whether the person is likely to commit a further offense, breach their bail conditions, or you know, somehow interfere with the administration of justice, interfere with a witness, or
how do you determine that? That's pretty subjective. I guess a judge does that, right?
That's right. There is a large element of judgment call here. The other thing about bail hearings is they occur on evidence which is often hearsay, submissions of counsel. So you'll have the Crown stand up and say, you know, Mr. Jones here has a criminal record with two previous occasions where he failed to show up in court, and he has no address, and for those reasons we're concerned that he's not going to show up. And then Mr. Jones's lawyer would stand up and provide further information. They might say, well, he doesn't have an address, but his family is here, and he's staying with his mom, and, you know, the two previous
failures. Like Tiangameshi.
Yeah, there you go. And then the third ground, or sometimes called the tertiary ground, which has been a controversial one, upon which somebody can be detained, even if they're likely to show up and aren't likely to commit further offenses. It's now phrased in terms of whether the detention of a person is necessary to maintain confidence in the administration of justice.
What does that mean?
Good question. There used to be a tertiary ground, which was referred to as the public interest.
What does tertiary ground mean?
Just like the third one.
Gotcha.
So there used to be a third ground to keep somebody in jail waiting for their trial if it was in the public interest. And that was a number of years ago struck down on the basis that it was just too vague to mean anything. Well, what does it mean to say you're being kept in jail because that's in the public interest, bearing in mind...
Broad strokes. What are the public interests?
Yeah. And bearing in mind, you have the right not to be detained, not to be denied reasonable bail without just cause.
Yeah, so how do you balance the two?
Well, that third one got replaced with this concept of the necessity of detaining somebody to maintain confidence in the administration of justice. And the sort of things that a judge or a justice of the peace would look at would include things like the apparent strength of the Crown's case, the seriousness of the offense, the possibility of the person receiving a long jail sentence. And what I think they would have in mind would be, let's imagine you had somebody who was a well-known person in the community. Let's say the mayor of a fictitious city is charged with committing a serious offense, and it's on video. Now, you might say, look, the mayor isn't going anywhere. They've got no history of failing to show up. They have a house and a job. They're the mayor, after all.
Yeah, highly visible.
Second of all, they're not likely to commit further offenses. They have no history of doing that, and you could impose conditions to make sure they aren't. But if you had a very serious offense, let's imagine the mayor is charged with murdering their spouse, and it's captured on video, and they've confessed to it. And
well, that's a no-brainer. Even I can judge that.
You say, well, look, even if that person's likely to show up, and even though they're unlikely to kill anyone else, after all, it was their spouse who's now dead, it may be necessary to say, look, the public is going to lose faith in the justice system if this person is just allowed to immediately be released.
Yeah.
So that now is a third ground upon which a person can wind up being held in jail waiting for their trial.
CFAX listeners, do you have a question about bail? Now's your chance. 250-386-1161, *1070 on your cell phone. You can email us, talk@cfax1070.com. You can also find us on Facebook. What happens, Michael, when we hear of stories that people defend when they're out on bail? Horrible stories of people that could have been kept incarcerated and were set free, only to commit another crime?
Happily, those are very rare. The vast majority of people who are on judicial interim release or bail show up as required to and don't commit any further offense. But there is actually a provision that in most cases, it's the Crown who would have to show cause why somebody should be kept in jail, show that they're not likely to turn up or that they're likely to commit some further offense. However, if you're charged with any sort of a serious indictable offense while you're on bail, the presumption is you stay in jail now, and it would be for that person to try and establish why they ought to be released. So it's called a reverse onus. And there are some other serious cases, like if you're charged with murder or serious drug offenses, the person who's charged, they need to persuade the judge that they're going to show up and not commit further offenses and that they should be released.
When we come back, I want to ask you about the money and how that plays a role in this. We're with Michael Mulligan. He's a lawyer at Mulligan, Tam and Pearson. You're listening to Legally Speaking here on CFAX 1070.
Call us 250-386-1161 or on your cell at *1070. Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070. Traffic got you down. We'll get you up and going with more traffic more often. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
We have some breaking news to report. Sleep Country has an unbeatable low price guarantee. According to multiple sources, Sleep Country will beat any mattress price by at least 5% on a similar bed. This is a historic moment. Any mattress, 5%. That's groundbreaking.
Actually, Janet, Sleep Country has been offering their unbeatable low price guarantee for over 20 years.
Okay, technically it's not breaking news, but it's certainly good news for all mattress shoppers everywhere.
Sleep Country Canada.
Wow, it's so immense.
What, the universe?
No, our sunroof.
The 2015 Volkswagen Tiguan with panoramic sunroof. Get up to $3,500 cash discount or 0% financing for up to 84 months on other select models during the Volkswagen DOS Summer Sales Event. Hurry, offer ends July 31st. Visit your Volkswagen dealer or VW.ca for details.
Earnings vary based on your effort.
Do you want to learn how to make money flipping houses right here in Victoria? If so, we have an amazing opportunity for you. We're looking for a small group of motivated individuals to join our real estate investing team. You'll learn our simple three-step system for flipping homes right here in the local area. This is Than Merrill, star of A&E's hit TV show Flip This House. My team and I are looking for a handful of people in the Victoria area who want to learn how to make money flipping houses in your spare time using other people's money. Victoria is a perfect market for my system, and next week I'm holding a free two-hour educational workshop where you will learn how to make money flipping homes and how to build long-term wealth with income properties.
To get two free tickets to Than's workshop, call 1-800-591-2316. Seating is extremely limited. Call in the next 10 minutes and you'll also reserve a free copy of Than's Money for Deals guide. That's 1-800-591-2316. That's 1-800-591-2316.
Crime Stoppers.
Central Saanich Police Service is asking for help following multiple incidents of theft from cars on July 11th. They happened in the Bella Vista Drive area. Property stolen includes cash, iPod, and a cell phone. Ensure your car is locked and all valuable items removed. If you know any information about this, please call local police or Crime Stoppers. 1-800-222-TIPS.
Hi, Matt of Speedy Glass here. Today we'll be working on Miss Ramirez's car, then on Miss Smith's. And yes, we have Mr. Thompson's minivan side window too. But nobody is sitting in the waiting room. They all took advantage of our shuttle service to be elsewhere. Free of charge, of course.
Take advantage of our free shuttle service and let us help you make better use of your time. Make an appointment today at speedyglass.ca.
Speedy Glass Repair. Speedy Glass Repair.
From cats and dogs to the people who love them. Petline with Jennifer Shaw. Sundays at 4 on CFAX 1070. Your voice, your time. It's Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070.
Welcome back to Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. We're talking about bail, and I was going to ask you about money. How does that factor in Canada, or does it? And explain that for us.
Much less than it does in the U.S. In the U.S., you'll see in TV and the movies, bail is usually set in an amount of money. So if you're rich, you'll pay it and get out.
But don't they get that? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, putting a nickel in a slot machine for some people. So, they, you know, it's not necessarily deterrent. Or do they gear it to that?
Well, they have jails full of poor people there. They've also got this privatized system of bail bondsmen, where if you're poor and you can't afford to pay the bail yourself, you can borrow the money at a huge fee from a bail bondsman who will then pay the bail. And if you don't show up, they'll have private sort of bounty hunter types
like
who will chase you down.
Like Dog the Bounty Hunter.
That's right. You'll get the tattooed guy with the gun, kick your hotel room in and drag you back to court. In Canada, we try not to take that approach. In Canada, our model usually involves more often bail supervision. So rather than relying on depositing cash in most cases, we would usually have a system here where a person would be required to comply with conditions which are monitored when they're on bail, things like reporting to a bail supervisor, keeping them advised of where their person's moving or working, that sort of thing, or complying with other conditions to make sure they're staying out of trouble, not drinking, not having any weapons, not contacting people, this sort of thing.
How do they ensure that?
Well, in serious case, I mean, in more minor cases, it would be a matter of the bail supervisor meeting with the person and interviewing them and getting those details from them and making sure they're showing up and know about their court date and are abiding by their conditions.
And we pay for that as taxpayers?
We do, but in contrast, there was a study done. If you detain somebody, one of the figures here was it's $183 a day to keep the person in jail, and the cost of supervising somebody on release is about $5 a day. So we pay sum of money to keep somebody in prison if it's unnecessary.
What, is that what it costs to stay at William Head?
Well, William Head's interesting. That one's federal. It's a little bit nicer place than most provincial jails.
Hence my question.
We also have here for serious offenses, we have a concept of what's called surety bail. Surety bail involves a responsible person in the community, maybe somebody's friend or relative, who agrees to supervise the person on bail. And if the person being supervised doesn't show up or follow all of the rules of bail, the surety needs to pay an amount of money. So you might set surety bail in, say, $5,000. The surety would have to show they could pay that if the person didn't follow all their conditions and turn up. And then it's the responsibility of the surety, a responsible person in the community that's been approved of by a justice of the peace, to make sure that person's complying and turns up. And if they don't, that person's on the hook for a pile of money.
How often do we see that?
You'll see it in serious cases. Like if a person is released on bail for a murder case, for example, that would be a common form of release.
How could you ever be released on bail in a murder charge? Describe that for us. Under what circumstances?
Well, in a murder case, the burden would be on the person charged to persuade. And in that case, it has to be a superior court judge.
This is all based on your not guilty until proven as such.
That's right. You're presumed to be innocent. It's a serious allegation. But with that being said, we would go through those conditions to detain somebody. And if a person charged with murder could persuade a judge that they're not going to flee, that they're going to follow their conditions and not have any other difficulty, and that it's not necessary to detain them to maintain confidence in the administration of justice. You know, let's imagine a person with no record, with long ties to the community, no criminal record, and they're charged with murder, but the case isn't perhaps that strong. You might well have a judge say, well, look, the person's likely to turn up and stay out of trouble. And if they follow conditions, they could be released. And the conditions might include things like a curfew, or they could even include electronic monitoring or frequent reporting.
How does electronic monitoring work?
Well, we don't have the most up-to-date technology in British Columbia. We've got a system here where there's an ankle bracelet that they can put on people that's tied in with their phone. And if they get too far away from a base station by the phone, or they tamper with it, an alarm goes off, and then the police would be alerted and they would rush over and arrest the person.
How heavy are those things on a person's ankle?
They don't look like a great fashion statement. but
it's not a bike clip.
Not a bike clip. There are better ones, which we may get here, if the budget allows, which would be GPS-based. So we could actually track the person exactly where they are, which would be perhaps more useful and sophisticated if you wanted to, say, allow the person to go to work during particular hours and back and forth to their house. That might allow more monitoring without just knowing, are they at their house at the moment?
So still an ankle bracelet kind of thing?
Yes, that's right. And they're set up so that if you tamper with it or try to cut it off, an alarm will go off and the police would show up. Police will also monitor bail conditions. So one of the conditions, which is not uncommon, would be a curfew condition, saying, look, you can be released, but you must be in your home between, 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. And the police will routinely go and monitor that, show up and knock on the door and say, is so-and-so here? And if they aren't there, they would then be a warrant for their arrest.
Well, aren't we just allowing ourselves to be monitored on a regular basis anyway with our cell phones? I mean, it's not much of a stretch to monitor criminals with GPS, or alleged criminals. Let's say that.
And that's important to remember, right? We're dealing with people who are presumed to be innocent. They may in fact be innocent. And from the perspective of somebody who's charged with an offense, their view may be, look, I'm innocent. I just didn't do it. And it can feel pretty oppressive if you are required to have an ankle bracelet on and be at home and follow rules and so forth, although I suppose not as oppressive as sitting in jail for 9 months only to go to court and be found not guilty. That
happens.
What's
the recourse for someone in that situation?
Typically nothing. And the reason the answer is typically nothing is that in our model, if a person is found to be not guilty, it's not a declaration of innocence. It's simply the judge saying, look, on the evidence that he or she has, or the jury has, they have a doubt about it. You may well have a circumstance where a judge says, look, I think this person likely did it, but that's not enough. I have a reasonable doubt about whether they did, so they're to be acquitted. And it's only if you could show that, for example, the person was prosecuted for some oblique purpose. If the police arrested somebody because they didn't like their, hair color or something, and they were doing it for an improper reason, that a person might be eligible for some compensation. But usually it's you're not guilty and terribly sorry about the 9 months you lost along with your job and home and family.
Yeah, wow. And you as a defense lawyer probably have been through that situation.
You see that. You'll have somebody who is detained, and it could be with a good reason, but they then are acquitted many months later, and there is no recourse for them.
We talked about the Bill Cosby case a couple of legally speakings ago, and there are new developments in it. I understand he could be questioned under oath about sex assault allegations against him after the California Supreme Court threw out a petition by his lawyers to dismiss a lawsuit against him. We're hearing also about a woman who claims that there was a sexual assault of some sort when she was 15 years old at the Playboy Mansion.
That's fascinating, watching the U.S. justice system try to unravel that case. Many of the things which they're now dealing with great difficulty, in particular the delay, and in many cases the claims are outside of their limitation period, we deal with that very differently in Canada. So it's remarkable to look at that. In Canada, if there was an allegation that you sexually assaulted a person who was 15, no matter how old that allegation is, you could be charged with it. And moreover, in British Columbia, you could be sued for it civilly. We've made the decision that we're not going to give people we're not going to bar those sort of claims, even by virtue of the passage of time. And you can see why, you know, we have made that policy decision looking at the Cosby case. Sometimes people who are victims of that sort of behavior are, because they've been victimized, going to be reluctant to make a complaint at the time. And we don't want to have a circumstance where if you commit a crime and victimize somebody in a way that they're incapable of making a timely complaint, nothing can be done about it.
How difficult or easy is it to prosecute historical crimes when it comes to allegations of sexual assault?
They're a challenge, and they're a challenge for both sides. Historical allegations can be a challenge from the Crown's point of view, bearing in mind they need to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. They can also be a serious challenge from an accused's point of view. The accused may be, by virtue of time going by, have problems like, alibis may be unavailable to them. Often, historic allegations aren't specified to a particular date or time. It would be sort of an allegation that somebody between, August of 1973 and, September of 1974 did commit a sexual assault, for example. And that can make it much more difficult for a person to be able to marshal the sort of evidence they might be able to if an allegation was more recent. Mm-hmm. If you're accused of committing a crime last Wednesday, you may well remember where you were last Wednesday.
Sure.
You may be able to call your coworker.
Well, and as a defense lawyer, I imagine that you've got the eggs in your basket.
It can be, but it can be harder to defend, and sometimes you're left with bare allegations and bare denials. A person says, look, this person did this to me in 1973, and the accused says it's simply false.
When do you hit the road for your summer holiday?
I've got about another 10 days to get my desk cleared off and get psychologically prepared for the motorhome.
So we'll see you next week?
You will.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, great. And we'll hear more about the RV trip heading south. We're with Michael Mulligan. He's a lawyer with Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. You've been listening to Legally Speaking here on CFAX 1070. I'm Pamela McCall.